You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Proposed zoning for a surface mine is causing quite a stir in Davis County, Kentucky. The mine would be in a rural area outside of Owensboro called Pleasant Ridge, where mining has existed for decades. This mine, though, would be located next to a Girl Scout camp. Rose Kristen Presson explores what this means not only for the camp, but for Pleasant Ridge, Owensboro, and Davis County's economic growth in recent years.
Camp Pennyroyal hosts thousands of Girl Scouts every year. The 180-acre site looks like your typical camp, primarily wooded, tents, cabins, trails. Property manager Jed Johnson explains.
It has an eight-acre lake that is spring-fed. It does have, 10 or 15 acres of open space. It is a fairly untouched site from the last 50 years.
Even under the soil, the land is rich with coal, and offers to pay the Girl Scouts in exchange for mining have been proposed in the past. It would, after all, probably help cushion the funds Girl Scouts make selling those cookies.
It's a flat no, because our commitment is that we keep these camps for our girls and for posterity.
That hasn't stopped areas surrounding Camp Pennyroyal from being mined. That part of Davis County called Pleasant Ridge has long been mined for coal. It brings in about $1 million in revenue annually for the county and the city of Owensboro through the coal severance tax. And now, a local mining company called Western Kentucky Minerals is working on a permit for yet another surface mine in Pleasant Ridge.
As far as Davis County, the permit we got going there with the 690 acres, it'll take us as long as 2 years to get all of our permits in order.
It's taking 2 years because the proposed mine would neighbor Camp Pennyroyal. Tim Rye, a permitting technician for Western Kentucky Minerals, says this permitting process started out normally. They acquired signed leases with the 14 landowners.
Talked to as many people as we could to let them know, and you know, we was proposing a new surface mine out there. We would be coming to the area, and most everything we got was good. I mean, in favor of all of it, you know.
But once they approached the county zoning committee with a proposal, they were met with some resistance. Not from the county, and not from the Girl Scouts of Kentuckiana, but from the community. People spoke in fiscal court, an online petition was created, yard signs began popping up with messages like, "Say no to coal." The county zoning commission, however, granted the permit for the mine. But Western Kentucky Minerals isn't quite in the clear to operate yet. Davis County is one of two in the state that allows appeals against permits like this. In all other 118 counties, if you can get the permit, you can mine. County Judge Executive Al Mattingly says the fiscal court heard hours of appeals and read hundreds of pages in reports. So far, they've upheld the zoning board's decision to allow the mine on Girl Scout Road, but they'll be hearing appeals until a 30-day period ends this Saturday. Even then, Mattingly thinks the appeals will continue.
And I am sure in this case it's probably going to go to the Court of Appeals and eventually the Supreme Court, Kentucky Supreme Court.
Mattingly says the fiscal court upheld the zoning ordinance because they could not see a violation in the permit application.
It's all about trying to balance your decision. In this case, there was no Solomon-like result. We were going to make somebody mad regardless of how we chose. We did what we thought was the best, and that's all that anybody can ask of us to do.
The court did recognize the unusual circumstance of the mine being located next to Camp Pennyroyal, and extra restrictions were set for this particular mine. For example, mine operations will halt on Sundays, holidays, and Saturdays after 6 p.m. Miners can't use backup bells. They'll have to use strobe lights to reduce noise pollution. State law requires that mines can't blast closer than 300 feet of a residence without written permission. Davis County Fiscal Court extended that to 500 feet and 2,000 feet from Camp Pennyroyal's main lodge. In addition, Western Kentucky Minerals will have to test the water quality in the camp's lake, monitor the dam's integrity, and restrict mining operations to inside the pit after 6 p.m. Laura Tucker is the CEO for the Girl Scouts of Kentuckiana. She says the council's priority is to work in partnership with Western Kentucky Minerals to form the best situation for both parties when the expected mining starts in a few years.
Just make sure that we're prepared that when this starts, that it has little effect on that camping experience for our girls.
Both Western Kentucky Minerals and the Girl Scouts of Kentuckiana are trying to allow the other's operations to run smoothly. Tucker says as CEO, her priorities are to protect the camp, but she liked to make the best out of the situation.
And the other thing is taking this experience and making it part of the educational process for girls. I mean, creating a coal badge, looking at the environment. You know, hopefully we've got some budding scientist out there that can look at the next generation of sustainable, reusable energy.
That means some of the coal workers will be interacting directly with girls, teaching about surface mining, the risks, and educating camp staff on safety procedures when the mine becomes active. One of the pillars of Girl Scouts is a connection with the outdoors, and environmentalism is heavily threaded in the program. But Tucker says it's important for Girl Scouts, especially ones in this region, to understand this industry and its role in their homes and in society.
You have an environmental aspect of it, but then you also have the fact that over 97% of Kentucky's energy comes from coal. You have families who need the money that have the right to sell their mineral rights. You have a local mining company struggling to exist, and you've got a community that needs a tax money base. So what we try to do is to really teach our girls to look at an issue critically and advocate for what they believe in.
But the Girl Scouts of Kentuckiana is focused on preparing for the potential opening of this mine in the coming years. Western Kentucky Minerals is working to get their zoning permit approved and begin mining, and both are publicly working together to ensure operations down the road will run smoothly. However, both parties, the community and the local government, are all, as Mattingly put it, playing the waiting game. If the appeals continue past this week and advance into higher courts, it'll be a long road ahead before anyone is certain if Western Kentucky Minerals will begin work on Girl Scout Road. For WKMS News, I'm Rose Kristen Presson.
After McCracken County resident Susan Guess found out her daughter Morgan was being bullied at school, she and Morgan founded the Guess Anti-Bullying Foundation to help get the word out on bullying and how to stop it. Last week, the Guess Foundation hosted anti-bullying advocate Jody Blanco. She's a best-selling author of a book which details the abuse she suffered at the hands of bullies in her youth. Shelley Baskin spoke with Blanco about her campaign to reach out to victims and bullies.
So your book, Please Stop Laughing at Me, tells the story of the bullying you faced in school. Just briefly, what did you go through?
From fifth grade through high school, I was the kid who no one wanted to be caught dead hanging out with. And I struggled to fit in. I was the outcast for the same reason so many other kids are today, simply for being different. I was teased and tormented, excluded, humiliated, the butt of every nasty prank and joke. I was physically abused. I was psychologically tormented. I was demeaned and belittled every day from fifth grade until high school graduation.
And what did you do to deal with the bullying?
Well, it's interesting because I'm 48 years old. So when I was being bullied, the term didn't even exist. It was considered a rite of passage and kids will be kids. And the adults in my life gave me very bad advice. They gave me all the cliches like ignore the bully and walk away. Leave them alone and they'll leave you alone. They're just jealous. And that's one of the reasons that I've taken up this crusade and I travel to schools all around the world and I do a day-long anti-bullying program called It's Not Just Joking Around, where I do student presentations, teacher workshops, and parent-family seminars, because I want to educate kids that it's not just joking around, and I want to educate the adults that the old cliches don't work, that you can't tell a kid to ignore the bullies, that you're only going to make it worse. So that's what I did in answer to your question. You know, I tried to be a good girl. I tried to follow the adults' advice.
And why didn't that work?
Because ignoring a bully never works. In the world of adult land, if you ignore someone who's annoying you, they will stop. In the world of adolescent land, the more you ignore the mean kids, the meaner they'll get until you get a response. And also, what's the one thing we tell kids all across America? Don't be a bystander. If you see someone getting bullied, defend that person. But then we'll turn around and say to that same child, oh, you're the one being bullied? Just ignore it. That's a mixed message. We're in effect encouraging that child to be a bystander in their own life. That's why these adult cliches don't work.
So when does, you know, the just kidding, the poking fun at each other, the sort of thing that you see a lot, become bullying?
Very simple. When it becomes hurtful. if you've got a group of friends and they're all joking around together and it's good-hearted, self-effacing humor, that's fine. But the minute someone's feelings get hurt, whether the joke was intended to be hurtful or not, it becomes bullying.
What message are you trying to send to the victims about the bullying?
Well, when I go into schools, what I basically do with the students is it's a reenactment. I'm basically reenacting key scenes from my youth, and it's held together by a message-infused narrative. And I have three primary messages that I preach to kids all across the country, whether they be bullies or victims or bystanders. First, that it's not just joking around, that bullying damages you for life. Two, that bullying isn't just the mean things you do, it's all the nice things you never do. That never including someone, even if it's not intentional, is a form of passive bullying. And lastly, if you do struggle to fit in, if you are bullied, or perhaps you're not bullied per se, but you just feel invisible at school, you're not on anyone's social radar, no one ever really includes you, that there's nothing wrong with you. That it's everything that's right about a person that typically makes them a target, and that you shouldn't ever change for anyone, that you should be true to yourself, and it's those who offend and hurt you that need to change.
What are the things that are making kids a target for bullying?
Well, there's a lot of myths about bullying that, oh, it's jealousy and insecurity, and that's really not true. Bullying is about the desperate need to fit in, run amok. And the bully and the victim are flip sides of the same coin. They just end up assuming different roles within an escalating adolescent dynamic. And what causes bullying typically, there is a typical profile of the bullied child, and it's what I call the ancient child. Most bullied kids are what you might refer to as old souls. They're often referred to as by their parents like this: oh, my daughter is 13 going on 33, or my son is more in common with my clients socially than his classmates. These kids who are bullied, these ancient children, are old for their age. And so adults tend to treat them as if they're mini adults, and that's the problem. They're not. Underneath all that outward maturity, they are still emotionally their biological age. And that's why adults, when they tell kids they're just jealous, it doesn't help. Because speaking for the bullied kids, which I certainly can, we don't care why we don't fit in. We don't care the reason why we never get invited to anything. We don't want grown-up explanations. We want action. We want you to help us find a way to make friends and fit in. Otherwise, deep down, every day, a part of us is dying just a little bit more.
And so what can victims, friends, and adults, and people that are seeing this bullying going on do to make them feel accepted?
Well, there's a series of things. Let's address parents first. If you've got a child that's being bullied, your first instinct is going to be to deal with the school and force the school to punish the bully. And your first instinct is going to be to put all of your attention on forcing the school to take action. That's a mistake. Too many kids end up losing their lives while the adults are busy working with the schools. The first thing you need to do if you find out your child is being bullied or just feels invisible, before you do anything with the school, is to perform triage on your child. The bullied child is bleeding in the form of loneliness, and the lonelier they get, the more desperate they become. So what you want to do is find your child a brand new social outlet completely separate from school, a drama club, a dance studio, something through a park district or a local library, at least 2 to 3 towns away from where you live. So there's a guarantee your child is going to make new friends with new faces. And have your child choose an activity they'd like to participate in and enroll them. This will give your child that vital connection with their peers that they need. It will stave off some of the loneliness that makes them in such a dangerous emotional place. And it will buy you the time you need to deal effectively with the school. Because I'm not saying it's not important to deal with the school, but your first obligation is to your hurting child. And what you need to do to calm that hurt is to help them find friends someplace else if school isn't providing them.
What about the bully? What kind of help is there for somebody who's actually causing the pain to the other person?
Well, one of the things that I always recommend when I go into schools and I do my faculty workshops is to supplement traditional punishment with something I call compassionate discipline. And all that means is exposing bullies to opportunities where they can access their natural sense of empathy like a muscle and develop it. For example, instead of a detention or a suspension for a group of kids that maybe, like, they're often referred to as the rich clique, instead of suspending the rich clique or giving them detentions, do a field trip for them. Have a chaperone escort them to a local homeless shelter where they have to serve food to the homeless, and each child has to interview at least one homeless person about their dreams and aspirations and how they got derailed. Then all the members of that mean clique who make fun of the lesser fortunate students at school have to come up with some innovative idea of how they can make the people at the shelter feel valued. Maybe it's painting a mural with the art teacher or putting on a talent show with the drama coach. And I guarantee you that if you've got a group of kids at school that are constantly picking on the kids and hand-me-downs, if they meet real people, if they're exposed to real indigents who have no one and nothing in this world, they will be sensitized to their plight, and they will never make fun of the kids who buy their jeans at Goodwill again. But if you want to rehabilitate bullies, you're not going to do it with traditional punishment. You're going to do it by exposing them to individuals and opportunities that help them access their empathy and develop it.
Jody Blanco is an anti-bullying advocate and the author of the book, Please Stop Laughing at Me. She tells the story of her experiences with bullies in her youth. She's been visiting students in the area this week to share her story. Jody, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for welcoming me, and I'm honored to have done your show.
As you may have heard, there are a few programming changes in the works here at WKMS, and when you want to know about WKMS programming, the man to talk to is Beyond the Edge host and program director, Tracy Ross, who's joining me here in the studio. So I suppose I should ask when these changes are happening and what they're going to be.
Well, the first changes will take place on September 1st, mm-hmm. and the first thing you're going to notice different is at 9 a.m. you'll hear Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Ah.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, if you don't know, is a very popular weekly quiz show on NPR. It's hosted by Peter Sagal, and Carl Castle serves as the announcer. They have a kind of a rotating panel, but it's always there are a few core members that are usually around. Paula Poundstone is seemingly on every single week. Mo Rocca, PJ O'Rourke, Tom Baudet. And you're going to hear that on Saturdays at 9 a.m. and then again Sundays at 5 p.m. After that, at 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 1st, you're going to hear a show called E-Town. Now, mm-hmm. E-Town is based in Boulder, Colorado, and it's basically a music show, but it also has an eye toward environmentalism or simply just giving back to your community.
Mm-hmm.
They have something called an Achievement Award, and at about the midway point of every program, they'll highlight a person who just made a difference in his or her community, and this can be defined many different ways. The host is Nick Forster. Now, Nick Forster has had a long career in the music industry. For over 30 years, I think he was a touring musician. He was a founding member of Hot Rise, which is a very famous bluegrass band. So when he talks to musicians, he knows what he's talking about. The next news show listeners will hear will be at 7 p.m. on Sunday, September 2nd, and it's something called TED Radio Hour. Now, TED is a nonprofit organization. It says it's devoted to ideas worth spreading. And it started as a four-day conference in California, and it's now grown into a global platform for identifying and spreading world-changing ideas. So basically, every week on TED, you'll have a different subject, a certain Episodes we're going to have coming up are Our Buggy Brain, The Pursuit of Happiness, etc. And each show is divided into three different segments, and they have three different speakers come on and deliver what is billed as the speech of their life in support of this idea. And it's hosted by Allison Stewart. A great show. Hopefully it will change your mind about certain things, or maybe put ideas or concepts into your mind that you never had before. Our fourth new program you actually won't hear until Thursday, September the 6th at 9 o'clock, and it is called The Jive House, and it is devoted to funk music from the 70s. Funk music is that blend of soul, jazz, and R&B along with African rhythms, and it's going to be hosted by John McMillan, a name that many people are probably familiar with because he's been a longtime host of Music from the Front Porch. He's going to be joined by Brad Robertson, who's a dentist here in Murray, and together they're going to spin the likes of Aretha Franklin, Sharon Jones, James Brown, Baby Huey, Ray Charles. It's going to be very groovy and very soulful. Those are the other new shows besides Sounds Good.
And that is the new jewel in our crown, isn't it?
Yes, Sounds Good is what I hope will become the flagship program on this channel. It's a way to connect the musical dots between all the different programs that we offer locally. And we currently have a lot of shows that they're very hard to define. They're very eclectic, but each in their own way kind of has a different approach to music. And I'm talking about, obviously, Music from the Front Porch, The Jazz Man Show, Juke Joint Shuffle, Beyond the Edge, House Blend, just lots of different shows. So what I want to do on Sounds Good is kind of present to you in a two-hour period a mix of all the different kinds of music you can hear on this station, and also bring in people from the community, people from our local and regional communities, from philanthropic organizations, newsmakers, anyone who has something to say and needs a place to say it. And I call it the front door to the station. If you really want to know what WKMS is about, then stop in, listen to Sounds Good. And that's going to be on weekdays from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. And it actually starts the day after Labor Day on Tuesday, September 4th.
But that's not the only thing that's happening. We're also moving a few things.
Yes, we are moving a few things. The first one is Fresh Air. Fresh Air has been on since we brought it to the station this last time from 11 until noon. We've moved it to 3 o'clock. So now you can hear Fresh Air just before All Things Considered, Monday through Friday. Also, This American Life, the repeat of This American Life, was heard through the week at noon. Now we've moved it to Sunday at 6 p.m. We've moved Imported, a growing and popular world music show hosted by Chris and Georgina Taylor, to 9 p.m. on Sunday, and then Hearts of Space moves to 10 p.m. And Jack Dressler, who hosts Classical Encore on the station, his program has been moved. It was on from 9 to 11 Sunday night, but now it's on twice Sunday. You can wake up with it from 5 to 7 a.m., or you can go to sleep with it from 11 p.m. until 1 a.m. Kentucky Tonight, which has been heard Tuesdays at noon, can now be heard Tuesdays at 2 p.m. And then our special programming, which could always be heard Thursday at noon, has been moved to Thursday at 2 p.m. And just the one last little programming reminder is the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, for the 7 performances they do a season that we broadcast, that has been moved from 7 p.m. Sunday night to 11 a.m. Sunday.
Well, and just in case we're getting too far into the weeds, we just want to mention that you can find all of these program changes at WKMS.org. WKMS Program Director Tracy Ross. Tracy, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
After the break, where is the best place to witness the upcoming solar eclipse in 2017? Here's a hint. It's closer than you think. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. In 2017, the U.S. will get its first full solar eclipse that will sweep across the entire country since 1918, and Western Kentucky will be in the path for best viewing. Some Hopkinsville residents and scientists are already preparing for this event. HCC Assistant Professor for Physics Scott Bain joins me now to talk about this upcoming eclipse. Thanks for joining me, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Scott, this eclipse will be able to be seen from basically a diagonal line from the northwest United States down to the southeastern portion of the United States on August 21st, 2017. Hopkinsville is the area of what NASA calls the greatest eclipse. What does that mean?
That means that this is where the eclipse will last the longest. It's for residents of Hopkinsville, it's going to last for 2 minutes and 40 seconds. The sun will be blocked for that amount of time. And this location here is where that's going to happen for the longest time. Every place else along the path of the eclipse will not be in total darkness for quite that long.
But people who could see it from other places will be in total darkness, but it may just be a much shorter period of time?
Yes, if I remember right, it starts at like a minute 30 seconds on the west coast and goes from about a minute 30 seconds long to about 2 minutes and 40 seconds long for the total eclipse.
Now, this line that we've talked about stretching from the northwest to the southeast, how broad of a spectrum do we have? How many miles in between this diagonal line could people see the eclipse?
The eclipse here in Kentucky at its widest is going to be about 70 miles wide. It's going to narrow down to, I think, around 50 or 60 miles wide at the east coast or the west coast end of the country.
And I've mentioned that this is the first time an eclipse will cross the entire country since 1918, but what are the odds of this ever happening again and western Kentucky being the greatest point of eclipse?
The odds of western Kentucky being the greatest point of eclipse ever again are rather small because there's a pattern to eclipses, but it's just off enough that the same spot is not going to be the location of greatest eclipse for a very long time, for a second eclipse after it happens once.
So what about listeners that we have maybe in Paducah or Murray? Would you, outside of the tourism opportunity for the city of Hopkinsville, would you recommend that they drive from Murray or Paducah to Hopkinsville to see this eclipse?
I think that, the eclipse will pass over Paducah, and I haven't actually checked on Murray, but it should pass through Murray too. They will still get to see the eclipse for well over 2 minutes, unless they really want to be in the location where it's going to last longest. There's not much reason for them to drive down here, but they can see it just fine from Paducah.
Now, a similar eclipse like this occurred in 2008, I think, over Russia and China. What type of tourist draw did it have? Do you have an idea of how many people Hopkinsville may expect?
I looked that up the other day, and the news source I found said there were about 10,000 people that went to a town in Russia to see the eclipse, and again, about 10,000 people for another town in China. So this could draw thousands of people to Hopkinsville and to other places along the path as well.
Is there a location already specified for the watch? I mean, to accommodate possibly 10,000 people, where would this be?
We are working on that. This is something that we're currently in discussion about, and we have reached out to local government and to businesses to let them know that we're going to expect this many people. We're doing it this early so we have enough time to prepare for 10,000 people coming into Hopkinsville so we can figure out the answers to questions like those.
Well, I'm sure we'll be having this conversation again in about 5 years, Scott. Scott Bain is an assistant professor of physics at Hopkinsville Community College. The greatest point of eclipse for the 2017 solar eclipse, and that's going to be in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Thank you very much, Scott Bain, for your time.
Thank you again.
Earlier this year, the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame inducted three West Kentuckians to the ranks of other great Kentucky journalists: DJ Everett of WKDZ, WHVO Radio in Cadiz, Chip Hutchinson of the Princeton Times-Leader, and Murray State University Professor Emeritus Dr. Robert McGahey. And today we begin a series of conversations with these gentlemen with a conversation with Dr. Robert McGahey, better known as Doc. Doc retired in 1997 after 30 years with the Journalism and Mass Communications Department, 23 years of which he spent as department chair. He taught part-time at Murray State until 2010. McGahey has won numerous awards for his teaching and is also a veteran broadcaster. On WKMS Airwaves, he's known for his two-man stand-up act with colleague and friend Bob Valentine. And Kate Lochte spoke with McGahey about his career and his take on journalism today.
How did you get into broadcasting?
With my dad.
And what were your first jobs?
I was from my sophomore year to my senior year, I covered Little League sports, even though I was playing baseball in high school. And I also had a Saturday morning jock show from 9 to 12. Swinging sounds on Saturday down south. Some old, some new, and all played just for you tops and pops of the past. Big ones on the charts. We'll be right back after this spot announcement. Oof, thank you, Spot.
So this year, the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame inducted you, and you join a lineage from Murray State University faculty. Tell me about some of your predecessors.
Well, in one of the first classes L.J. Horton, my predecessor, was in, and chief, as he was called then, he had a distinguished career at the Post-Dispatch in St. Louis before he came here. And then the next one, we had a couple. John Mack, of course, made it in, John Mack Carter. And then I tried for years to get Ray Mofill in. We finally got him in. And sadly enough, it was about 6 months after Mama Mo, his wife, died. So Ruth Ann, his daughter, was there to accept it, and that was good. And then last year, we had Bill Bartleman and Jackie Hayes.
So it's like a family.
It is. It really is.
Well, listen, I'd like to know, in the midst of your long tenure at Murray State University and the growth of the department that journalism has always been a part of, and it's hard to reference that department because it's sort of changed names a lot over the years. You grew the department, I think it was 45 majors to over 400. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like you started accreditation,
yes.
National accreditation, getting that and renewing it, which is a big effort with your faculty. There's just an awful lot to talk about in your academic career. I'd like to know, what do you feel is your greatest achievement over the years?
Well, individually, as far as honors, the one that I think I prize the most, 1987, I got the Frank Stanton Fellow, and that's the Distinguished Broadcast Educator in America. And as you probably know, I didn't teach a lot of broadcast. I taught broadcast news, but I was over WKMS and TV11 and worked with it. But the year I received that, they have a big annual meeting, I guess, of International Radio and TV Society. And it's downtown in New York City. And the dais seats 48 people. There are four rows of 12 stacked up. That award, that night, it was at the Roosevelt Hotel. The vice president of Westinghouse gave it to me. Nice big plaque and a check, which covered the trip because we didn't have much university funds back then, as usual.
Well, I've been wondering how many students have come and gone through your classrooms.
I tried to figure that up one day. In the 168 class for, say, 36 years, we have 145 to 50 in the fall and about 100 in the spring. So it works out to close to 8,000 students in that one class. And what's funny, the ones that have gone on and graduate with our major, I can remember most of them because we put out that placement book, and I can recognize pictures with it, and I go back and look at them from time to time, particularly before homecoming, so I can recognize some people. But I'll have homecoming, somebody will come up, and they'll say, you know, I had you in class, and I know it was 168, the big class, and I said, well, I can't think of your name, but if I remember correctly, you sat up near the top, and you didn't come a whole lot, did you? And 80% of the time, I'm right.
I know you used humor in your classroom, and that's a real boon for students. I'm going to turn a little serious now because there's so much talk out there about the demise of journalism and the death of papers and the disappearance of fact-based news. Do you have any opinions about this?
Yes, and you just took part of my speech when I do my acceptance speech. The thing that I've noticed is that when I started, of course, it was just almost archaic, the way in which we produced news on both radio and the print. And but the content was pretty good, and you had something called a copy editor and a proofreader, which the old green eyeshade, and they don't have those anymore. And the traditional media, I think, do a pretty good job, okay? But they still they let things slide. And I can run you about 10 grammar things that you just see all the time. It's no longer a typo. Somebody just doesn't know. But the so-called social media, there are no gatekeepers. And so, therefore, you can't trust the content. And people are citing things that they've seen on blogs or tweeters and all this. Well, there's no verification on it. is like you said, and they're calling that part of journalism, which it is, yeah, content and being able to believe it, you can't do it anymore.
I've done some thinking about the journalism evolving around the social media and tracking stories through posts and Twitter feeds, and I don't understand how you get to verification. That must be very hard.
Well, that's what's, I don't know. But if you get something from the AP or like that, you pretty well know some professional person has seen it. Now, they may screw up, miss something, but you can almost count on it. And you can't on the other. You're right. Now, more and more, I think, the ones that are legitimate, when they run the story, they'll put a source on it. See Wikipedia, which I don't know if that's too good a source either. But they'll cite a source so you can at least check on it.
Well, what do you think consumers should do about this? What do you think will evolve? We're obviously in a time of great transition.
Well, I think one thing is that they need to read or listen to a multitude and check them against it. If you're staying with even any one or two, then you've got a slant version, you know, if it's liberal, conservative, whatever it might be.
Doc, congratulations.
Thank you.
Kate Lochte spoke with Dr. Robert McGahey, one of three West Kentuckians inducted into the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame this year. We'll feature conversations with DJ Everett of WKDZ, WHVO Radio in CADIS, and Chip Hutchinson of the Princeton Times-Leader in the coming weeks. When we return, we'll take you to a ceremony reinterring Mississippian-era Native American remains in Wycliffe. Then we'll follow up on a previous interview in this program that looked into a proposed Paducah development plan. This time we'll speak with a Paducah resident about his concerns over what that plan contains. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Earlier this month, we spoke with Bruce Brockenbro and Steve Doolittle of the Paducah Riverfront Development Authority about a proposal to enhance the city's downtown, lower town, and riverfront. It's called the Renaissance Area Master Plan, or RAMP, and while it has its supporters, it's also drawn criticism. Among those who've expressed reservations is retired journalist and Paducah resident Bob Hopper. Even though Mr. Hopper is a member of the Paducah Renaissance Alliance Board of Advisors, he's agreed to give us his personal perspectives on those reservations, as well as some possible solutions, and he joins us on the line. Mr. Hopper, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for this chance to have my say. About the plan, there are some things that I certainly agree with. We need much greater work on making the pathways in the downtown, lower town, riverfront more attractive to visitors to the city, more sensible, creative wayfinding. You know, the areas that one travels off the interstate into the downtown area, those are very important to people who've heard wonderful things about Paducah, and then they start wondering, well, gee, what were we missing? And it takes a while to get to the heart of where all the action is. And RAMP addressed some of that, not in much detail, but they at least addressed the need for it. I fully support that. I support the idea of greater linkages between downtown, riverfront, and lower town, but some of the follow-through wasn't there, and I know this was conceived mainly as just an outline of things that need to be done, but we've got a lot of things that are already going on that are very positive, and I would have liked to have seen more attention given to building on our existing strengths. For example, the plan called for new structures in the block where the the gazebo parking lot is downtown to create kind of a market square thing. Well, we already have Market Square, and don't build some new retail there to compete with all the existing retail and the empty spaces in downtown buildings. Rather, enhance that as a park area, keeping the village square idea that we already have, and then make a concerted effort to find out what needs to be done to make the existing buildings along the Broadway spine more attractive to developers, which is a treasure and a jewel that town's half Paducah's size would love to have. And we have some bright people here. We have some people who are well-heeled and well-intentioned, but have not necessarily been able to work with developers in the city to get some of these old, large buildings we have downtown shaped up for development as retail, restaurants, offices, residential, boutique hotel, you name it. We have those strengths that should be built on, not neglected. Instead, they focus too much, I think, on this proposed development at 2nd and Broadway, and there's a lot of community opposition. I have not seen the redone plan. Maybe they're going to address that.
I did get the impression that most of the concerns that people have about the plan isn't so much about the necessity of development. As you said, it's more about the specifics. That would be fair to say, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and again, I think we have such a visually striking downtown, lower town, and potentially visually striking riverfront. We should put every ounce of creativity and smarts into enhancing these rather than coming up to fix problems that don't exist. And also, we've got to develop the second, third, fourth floors of some of these buildings into affordable living space. We want young, vibrant people living downtown again. They can't necessarily buy expensive condos. Maybe some creativity should go into how to develop some more residential space downtown so that young people who would love to live down there but can't afford it could. Cities that grow and progress are attractive to young people, not just old gray beards like myself.
I get the feeling that, in spite of all the emotions that this contention over ramp has engendered in some people, and the frustration some may be feeling, I don't get the impression that there's a lot of personal acrimony. It's my impression that the people that have shown up at these meetings, the one I've seen at least, don't seem to be angry at one person. In fact, I would even go so far as to say it seems these are people that love their community, no matter what side of the issue they're on, and they understand that about each other.
I think so, yes. I think you're exactly right. Part of it may be the specific nature of the task handed ramp. Maybe it was too limited, too narrowly focused. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe they thought Broadway would take care of itself. I think we have to be a little bit more proactive than that. I mean, a city that's serious about renewing itself cannot let a jewel like the Columbia Theater languish for years. Can't happen. People don't want it to happen. The plan didn't necessarily address that as much as some of us would have liked. Well-intentioned, yes. Parts of their framework we can put in place right now. Already in Lower Town, you know, with the paint the fire plugs thing, doesn't sound like a big deal. But I tell you, there are some really neat-looking fire plugs now where there used to be just some ugly stumps. The tank farms don't have to be ugly. They can be maintained and painted. Industrial infrastructure doesn't have to be ugly.
Well, how would you get companies like that, perhaps large corporations based elsewhere, how would you get them to buy into this?
I would put it this way. Why don't we want to work together for the common good? We want businesses that want to be part of the community. And our locally owned businesses, our corporations, they give back big time. Our out-of-town companies, they also want to be part of what we're doing. And when they are based or located in a community that is thriving and progressive, their employees are happier when they go to work. If the company can't afford to improve and enhance their appearance, maybe they can solicit help from the community. And there's no reason for downtown buildings not to be cleaned up. There are property owners who do a wonderful job maintaining the community. And there are others that maybe they can't, but then they can ask for help.
Bob Hopper is a member of the Paducah Renaissance Alliance Board of Advisors. He joins us from his home in Paducah. Mr. Hopper, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
This past week, hundreds gathered at Wickliffe Mound State Historic Site to close a chapter in the Native American history of our region. They witnessed a ceremony honoring the reburial of the remains of Mississippian area mound builders who lived in our area almost 1,000 years ago. For over 50 years, the owners of the land that now makes up the historic site displayed them as part of a tourist attraction called Ancient Buried City. They were removed in 1991 and finally laid to rest last summer. And as Angela Hatton reports, last week's ceremony gave many who attended a sense of peace as well.
The sky is clear blue at Wickliffe Mounds as a crowd of young and old gather for the public ceremony. Chairs and a podium are set up near one of the mounds. It's a relatively small, grassy hill, no more than 3 feet high. But it's impossible to watch the ceremony without seeing the mound, a reminder of the history of the site. Wickliffe Mounds has been a popular tourist attraction since the 1930s, first as privately owned land, then belonging to Murray State University, and now to Kentucky State Parks. For many, like Richard Young, one memory about the mounds stands out.
As a very young child, I was brought to the mounds by my parents and remember very vividly seeing the human remains on display.
The idea that you could display human remains and charge admission to do that was disgusting. It's disgraceful to me.
Jefferson Keel is the lieutenant governor of the Chickasaw Nation, the last Native Americans to own land in western Kentucky. Keel says he doesn't have a problem with archaeologists studying Native American land for scientific discovery. It's the lack of respect for human bodies that bothers him.
We had to change the way people were thinking and the attitude towards this displaying of these human remains, because a lot of people don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Murray State archaeology professor Kit Wessler was one of the first in his field to recognize the need to respect Native American graves. Wessler took over Wickliffe Mounds in the early 1980s. He says almost immediately, Native American advocates began contacting him about getting the bodies taken off display.
What the Native Americans had been telling me was, if you want to go study the history of white people or black people or Asian people in North America, you go to a history museum. But if you want to study the past of Native Americans, you go to a natural history museum where they're displayed right next to stuffed animals and dinosaur bones. And there's a fundamental double standard there.
Wessler says as an archaeologist, it was tough for him to come to terms with the idea of reburial.
From the archaeological point of view, reburial represents a loss of data because we don't know what new techniques will be developed in 10 or 20 years that could give us a lot more data from any set of artifacts or remains that we might have. So once we rebury them, we can no longer study them.
Wessler says he changed his mind when he started to think of the Native Americans' burial sites as family graves instead of artifacts. Wessler says since then he's worked to strike a balance between archaeological research and respect for the dead. Working with students, he cataloged the details of the bones and then rewrapped them for reburial. Wickliffe Mounds manager Carla Hildebrand says Wessler's research means the historical information about the remains will never be truly lost.
But the actual bones are reburied back in the ground where they belong.
Many attendees call the public ceremony closure. Thomas Pierce, representative of the American Indian Movement, says he's waited a long time to see the Wickliffe Mounds people laid back to rest. He hopes the ceremony will spark interest in the Native American culture.
I think that if non-Indians want to know about Indian people, they should just ask them, because we're a living people. We're here today. We haven't gone anywhere. We're not going anywhere. And we love to educate people about our ways and our culture.
The crowd falls silent as five Chickasaw dancers come out to perform in honor of the dead. As they circle and sing, someone points to the sky. Three eagles have appeared in the blue above, circling with the dancers. When the ceremony ends, the eagles are gone. To Pierce, their presence is more than a mere coincidence.
Those were the spirits of our people. And so this is a very important thing that happened here today.
For WKMS News, I'm Angela Hatton.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance.
If you have comments or questions about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.